Many of these beings nevertheless feel slightly nervous at the thought of dropping their astral form for the subtler causal one. The astral world is free from unwilling death, disease, and old age. These three dreads are the curse of Earth, where man has allowed his consciousness to identify itself almost wholly with a frail physical body requiring constant aid from air, food, and sleep in order to exist at all. Physical death is attended by the disappearance of breath and the disintegration of fleshly cells. Astral death consists of the disbursement of lifetrons, those manifest units of energy which constitute the life of astral beings. At physical death, a being loses his consciousness of flesh and becomes aware of his subtle body in the astral world. Experiencing astral death in due time, a being thus passes from the consciousness of astral birth and death to that of physical birth and death. These recurrent cycles of astral and physical encasement are the ineluctable destiny of all unenlightened beings. Scriptural definitions of heaven and hell sometimes stir man's deeper than subconscious memories of his long series of experiences in the blithesome astral and disappointing terrestrial worlds. "Beloved Master," I asked, "will you please describe more in detail the difference between rebirth on the earth and in the astral and causal spheres? Man as an individualized soul is essentially causal-bodied," my guru explained. "That body is a matrix of the 35 ideas required by God as the basic or causal thought forces from which he later formed the subtle astral body of 19 elements and the gross physical body of 16 elements. The 19 elements of the astral body are mental, emotional, and lifetronic. The 19 components are intelligence, ego, feeling, mind, sense consciousness, 5 instruments of knowledge, the subtle counterparts of the senses of sight, hearing, smell, taste, touch, 5 instruments of action, the mental correspondence for the executive abilities to procreate, excrete, talk, walk, and exercise manual skill, and 5 instruments of life force, those empowered to perform the crystallizing, assimilating, eliminating, metabolizing, and circulating functions of the body. This subtle astral encasement of 19 elements survives the death of the physical body, which is made of 16 gross metallic and non-metallic elements. God thought out different ideas within himself and projected them into dreams. Lady Cosmic Dream thus sprang out decorated in all her colossal endless ornaments of relativity. In 35 thought categories of the causal body, God elaborated all the complexities of man's 19 astral and 16 physical counterparts. By condensation of vibratory forces, first subtle, then gross, he produced man's astral body and finally his physical form. According to the law of relativity, by which the prime simplicity has become the bewildering manifold, the causal cosmos and causal body are different from the astral cosmos and astral body. The physical cosmos and physical body are likewise characteristically at variance with the other forms of creation. The fleshly body is made of the fixed, objectified dreams of the Creator. The dualities are ever present on Earth: disease and health, pain and pleasure, loss and gain. Human beings find limitation and resistance in three-dimensional matter. When man's desire to live is severely shaken by disease or other causes, death arrives. The heavy overcoat of the flesh is temporarily shed. The soul, however, remains encased in the astral and causal bodies. The adhesive force by which all three bodies are held together is desire. The power of unfulfilled desires is the root of all man's slavery. Physical desires are outed in egotism and sense pleasures. The compulsion or temptation of sensory experience is more powerful than the desire force connected with astral attachments or causal perceptions. Astral desires center around enjoyment in terms of vibration. Astral beings enjoy the ethereal music of the spheres and are entranced by the sight of all creation as exhaustless expressions of changing light. The astral beings also smell, taste, and touch light. Astral desires are thus connected with an astral being's power to precipitate all objects and experiences as forms of light or as condensed thoughts or dreams. Causal desires are fulfilled by perception only. The nearly free beings who are encased only in the causal body see the whole universe as realizations of the dream ideas of God. They can materialize anything and everything in sheer thought. Causal beings therefore consider the enjoyment of physical sensations or astral delights as gross and suffocating to the soul's fine sensibilities. Causal beings work out their desires by materializing them instantly. Those who find themselves covered only by the delicate veil of the causal body can bring universes into manifestation even as the creator. Because all creation is made of the cosmic dream texture, the soul thinly clothed in the causal has vast realizations of power. A soul, being invisible by nature, can be distinguished only by the presence of its body or bodies. The mere presence of a body signifies that its existence is made possible by unfulfilled desires. A, so long as the soul of man is encased in one, two, or three body containers, sealed tightly with the corks of ignorance and desires, he cannot merge with the sea of spirit. When the gross physical receptacle is destroyed by the hammer of death, the other two coverings, astral and causal, still remain to prevent the soul from consciously joining the omnipresent life. When desirelessness is attained through wisdom, its power disintegrates the two remaining vessels. The tiny human soul emerges, free at last, it is one with the measureless amplitude. I asked my divine guru to shed further light on the high and mysterious causal world. The causal world is indescribably subtle, he replied. In order to understand it, one would have to possess such tremendous powers of concentration that he could close his eyes and visualize the astral cosmos and the physical cosmos in all their vastness, the luminous balloon with the solid bars kit as existing in ideas only. If by this superhuman concentration one succeeded in converting or resolving the two cosmoses with all their complexities into sheer ideas, he would then reach the causal world and stand on the borderline of fusion between mind and matter. There one perceives all created things, solids, liquids, gases, electricity, energy, all beings, gods, men, animals, plants, bacteria as forms of consciousness. Just as a man can close his eyes and realize that he exists, even though his body is invisible to his physical eyes and is present only as an idea. Whatever a human being can do in fancy, a causal being can do in reality. The most colossal imaginative human intelligence is able, in mind only, to range from one extreme of thought to another, to skip mentally from planet to planet, or tumble endlessly down a pit of eternity, or soar rocket-like into the galaxied canopy, or scintillate like a searchlight over Milky Ways and the starry spaces. But beings in the causal world have a much greater freedom, and can effortlessly manifest their thoughts into instant objectivity, without any material or astral obstruction or karmic limitation. Causal beings realize that the physical cosmos is not primarily constructed of electrons, nor is the astral cosmos basically composed of lifetrons. Both in reality are created from the minutest particles of God thought, chopped and divided by Maya, the law of relativity which intervenes to apparently separate the noumenon from his phenomena. Souls in the causal world recognize one another as individualized points of joyous spirit. Their thought things are the only objects which surround them. Causal beings see the difference between their bodies and thoughts to be merely ideas. As a man, closing his eyes, can visualize a dazzling white light or a faint blue haze, so causal beings by thought alone are able to see, hear, feel, taste, and touch. They create anything, or dissolve it, by the power of cosmic mind. Both death and rebirth in the causal world are in thought. Causal-bodied beings feast only on the ambrosia of eternally new knowledge. They drink from the springs of peace, roam on the trackless soil of perceptions, swim in the ocean endlessness of bliss. Lo! See their bright thought bodies zoom past trillions of spirit-created planets, fresh bubbles of universes, wisdom stars, spectral dreams of golden nebulae, all over the sky blue bosom of infinity. Many beings remain for thousands of years in the causal cosmos. By deeper ecstasies the freed soul then withdraws itself from the little causal body and puts on the vastness of the causal cosmos. All the separate eddies of ideas, particularized waves of power, love, will, joy, peace, intuition, calmness, self-control, and concentration melt into the ever-joyous sea of bliss. No longer does the soul have to experience its joy as an individualized wave of consciousness, but is merged in the one cosmic ocean, with all its waves' eternal laughter, thrills, throbs. When a soul is out of the cocoon of the three bodies, it escapes forever from the law of relativity and becomes the ineffable ever-existent. Behold the butterfly of omnipresence, its wings etched with stars and moons and suns. The soul expanded into spirit remains alone in the region of lightless light, darkless dark, thoughtless thought, intoxicated with its ecstasy of joy in God's dream of cosmic creation. A free soul. I ejaculated in awe. When a soul finally gets out of the three jars of bodily delusions, Master continued, it becomes one with the infinite without any loss of individuality. Christ had won this final freedom even before he was born as Jesus. In three stages of his past, symbolized in his earth life as the 3 days of his experience of death and resurrection, he had attained the power to fully arise in spirit. The undeveloped man must undergo countless earthly and astral and causal incarnations in order to emerge from his three bodies. A master who achieves this final freedom may elect to return to earth as a prophet to bring other human beings back to God, or like myself he may choose to reside in the astral cosmos. There a savior assumes some of the burden of the inhabitants' karma and thus helps them to terminate their cycle of reincarnation in the astral cosmos, and go on permanently to the causal spheres. Or a freed soul may enter the causal world to aid its beings to shorten their span in the causal body and thus attain the absolute freedom. Resurrected One, I want to know more about the karma which forces souls to return to the three worlds. I could listen forever, I thought, to my omniscient master. Never in his earth life had I been able at one time to assimilate so much of his wisdom. Now for the first time I was receiving a clear, definite insight into the enigmatic interspaces on the checkerboard of life and death. The physical karma or desires of man must be completely worked out before his permanent stay in astral worlds becomes possible, my guru elucidated in his thrilling voice. Two kinds of beings live in the astral spheres. Those who still have earthly karma to dispose of and who must therefore re-inhabit a gross physical body in order to pay their karmic debts could be classified, after physical death, as temporary visitors to the astral world rather than as permanent residents. Beings with unredeemed earthly karma are not permitted after astral death to go to the high causal sphere of cosmic ideas, but must shuttle to and fro from the physical and astral worlds only, conscious successively of their physical body of 16 gross elements, and of their astral body of 19 subtle elements. After each loss of his physical body, however, an undeveloped being from the earth remains for the most part in the deep stupor of the death sleep and is hardly conscious of the beautiful astral sphere. After the astral rest, such a man returns to the material plane for further lessons, gradually accustoming himself, through repeated journeys, to the worlds of subtle astral texture. Normal or long-established residents of the astral universe, on the other hand, are those who, freed forever from all material longings, need return no more to the gross vibrations of Earth. Such beings have only astral and causal karma to work out. At astral death these beings pass to the infinitely finer and more delicate causal world, shedding the thought form of the causal body at the end of a certain span, determined by cosmic law. These advanced beings then return to Hiranyaloka or a similar high astral planet, reborn in a new astral body to work out their unredeemed astral karma. My son, you may now comprehend more fully that I am resurrected by divine decree, Sri Yukteswar continued, as a savior of astrally reincarnating souls coming back from the causal sphere, in particular, rather than of those astral beings who are coming up from the earth. Those from the earth, if they still retain vestiges of material karma, do not rise to the very high astral planets like Hiranyaloka. Just as most people on earth have not learned through meditation acquired vision to appreciate the superior joys and advantages of astral life and thus, after death, desire to return to the limited, imperfect pleasures of Earth, so many astral beings, during the normal disintegration of their astral bodies, fail to picture the advanced state of spiritual joy in the causal world and, dwelling on thoughts of the more gross and gaudy astral happiness, yearn to revisit the astral paradise. Heavy astral karma must be redeemed by such beings before they can achieve after astral death a permanent stay in the causal thought world, so thinly partitioned from the Creator. Only when a being has no further desires for experiences in the pleasing to the high astral cosmos, and cannot be tempted to go back there, does he remain in the causal world, completing the work of redeeming all causal karma or seeds of past desires. The confined soul thrusts out the last of the three corks of ignorance and, emerging from the final jar of the causal body, commingles with the eternal. Now do you understand? Master smiled so enchantingly. Yes, through your grace. I am speechless with joy and gratitude. Never from song or story had I ever received such inspiring knowledge. Though the Hindu scriptures refer to the causal and astral worlds and to man's three bodies, how remote and meaningless those pages compared with the warm authenticity of my resurrected master. For him indeed existed not a single undiscovered country from whose bourne no traveler returns. The interpenetration of man's three bodies is expressed in many ways through his threefold nature, my great guru went on. In the wakeful state on earth a human being is conscious more or less of his three vehicles. When he is sensuously intent on tasting, smelling, touching, listening, or seeing, he is working principally through his physical body. Visualizing or willing, he is working mainly through his astral body. His causal medium finds expression when man is thinking or diving deep in introspection or meditation. The cosmical thoughts of genius come to the man who habitually contacts his causal body. In this sense, an individual may be classified broadly as a material man, an energetic man, or an intellectual man. A man identifies himself about 16 hours daily with his physical vehicle. Then he sleeps. If he dreams, he remains in his astral body, effortlessly creating any object even as do the astral beings. If man's sleep be deep and dreamless, for several hours he is able to transfer his consciousness, or sense of I-ness, to the causal body. Such sleep is revivifying. A dreamer is contacting his astral and not his causal body. His sleep is not fully refreshing. I had been lovingly observing Sri Yukta's war while he gave his wondrous exposition. Angelic Guru, I said, your body looks exactly as it did when last I wept over it in the Puri Ashram. Oh yes, my new body is a perfect copy of the old one. I materialize or dematerialize this form any time at will, much more frequently than I did while on Earth. By quick dematerialization, I now travel instantly by light express from planet to planet or, indeed, from astral to causal or to physical cosmos. My divine guru smiled. Though you move about so fast these days, I had no difficulty in finding you at Bombay. Oh master, I was grieving so deeply about your death. Ah, wherein did I die? Isn't there some contradiction? Sri Yukteswar's eyes were twinkling with love and amusement. You were only dreaming on Earth. On that Earth you saw my dream body, he went on. Later you buried the dream image. Now my finer fleshly body which you behold and are even now embracing rather closely is resurrected on another finer dream planet of God. Someday that finer dream body and finer dream planet will pass away. They too are not forever. All dream bubbles must eventually burst at a final wakeful touch. Differentiate, my son Yogananda, between dreams and reality. This idea of Vedantic resurrection struck me with wonder. I was ashamed that I had pitied Master when I had seen his lifeless body at Puri. I comprehended at last that my guru had always been fully awake in God, perceiving his own life and passing on earth, and his present resurrection, as nothing more than relativities of divine ideas in the cosmic dream. I have now told you, Yogananda, the truths of my life, death, and resurrection. Grieve not for me, Rather broadcast everywhere the story of my resurrection from the God-dreamed earth of men to another God-dreamed planet of astrally garbed souls. New hope will be infused into the hearts of misery-mad, death-fearing dreamers of the world. Yes, Master. How willingly would I share with others my joy at his resurrection? On earth my standards were uncomfortably high, unsuited to the natures of most men. Often I scolded you more than I should have. You passed my test, your love shone through the clouds of all reprimands. He added tenderly, I have also come today to tell you, never again shall I wear the stern gaze of censure. I shall scold you no more. How much I had missed the chastisements of my great guru. Each one had been a guardian angel of protection. Dearest Master, rebuke me a million times, do scold me now. I shall chide you no more. His divine voice was grave, yet with an undercurrent of laughter. You and I shall smile together, so long as our two forms appear different in there, my a dream of God. Finally we shall merge as one in the cosmic beloved, our smiles shall be his smile, our unified song of joy vibrating throughout eternity to be broadcast to God-tuned souls. Sri Yukta's war gave me light on certain matters which I cannot reveal here. During the 2 hours that he spent with me in the Bombay hotel room, he answered my every question. A number of world prophecies uttered by him that June day in 1936 have already come to pass. I leave you now, beloved one. At these words I felt Master melting away within my encircling arms. My child, his voice rang out, vibrating into my very soul firmament, whenever you enter the door of Nirvikalpa Samadhi and call on me, I shall come to you in flesh and blood, even as today. With this celestial promise Sri Yukta's war vanished from my sight. A cloud voice repeated in musical thunder, tell all. Whosoever knows by Nirvikalpa realization that your earth is a dream of God can come to the finer dream created planet of Hiranyaloka, and they find me resurrected in a body exactly like my earthly one. Yogananda, tell all. Gone was the sorrow of parting. The pity and grief for his death, long robber of my peace, now fled in stark shame. Bliss poured forth like a fountain through endless, newly opened soul pores. Anciently clogged with disuse, they now widened in purity at the driving flood of ecstasy. Subconscious thoughts and feelings of my past incarnations shed their karmic taints, lustrously renewed by Sri Yukta's war's divine visit. In this chapter of my autobiography I have obeyed my guru's behest and spread the glad tiding, though it confound once more an incurious generation. Groveling, man knows well, despair is seldom alien, yet these are perversities, no part of man's true lot. The day he wills, he is set on the path to freedom. Too long has he hearkened to the dank pessimism of his dust thou art counselors, heedless of the unconquerable soul. I was not the only one privileged to behold the resurrected guru. One of Sri Yukteswar's chelas was an aged woman, affectionately known as Ma, mother, whose home was close to the Puri hermitage. Master had often stopped to chat with her during his morning walk. On the evening of March 16, 1936, Ma arrived at the ashram and asked to see her guru. Why? Master died a week ago. Swami Sabananda, now in charge of the Puri hermitage, looked at her sadly. That's impossible. She smiled a little. Perhaps you are just trying to protect the guru from insistent visitors? No. Sabananda recounted details of the burial. Come, he said, I will take you to the front garden to Sri Yukteswarji's grave. Ma shook her head. There is no grave for him. This morning at 10 o'clock he passed in his usual walk before my door. I talked to him for several minutes in the bright outdoors. Come this evening to the ashram, he said. I am here. Blessings pour on this old grey head. The deathless guru wanted me to understand in what transcendent body he had visited me this morning. The astounded Sabananda knelt before her. Ma, he said, what a weight of grief you lift from my heart. He is risen. Chapter 44. With Mahatma Gandhi at Wardha. Welcome to Wardha. Mahadev Desai, secretary to Mahatma Gandhi, greeted Miss Bletch, Mr. Wright, and myself with these cordial words and the gift of wreaths of Kadar, homespun cotton. Our little group had just dismounted at the Wardhouse station on an early morning in August, glad to leave the dust and heat of the train. Consigning our luggage to a bullock cart, we entered an open motor car with Mr. Desai and his companions, Babasa Hebdishmuk and Dr. Pingale. A short drive over the muddy country roads brought us to Maganwadi, the ashram of India's political saint. Mr. Desai led us at once to the writing room where, cross-legged, sat Mahatma Gandhi. Pen in one hand and a scrap of paper in the other, on his face a vast, winning, warm-hearted smile. "Welcome," he scribbled in Hindi. It was a Monday, his weekly day of silence. Though this was our first meeting, we beamed on each other affectionately. In 1925 Mahatma Gandhi had honored the Ranchi school by a visit, and had inscribed in its guest book a gracious tribute. The tiny 100-pound saint irradiated physical, mental, and spiritual health. His soft brown eyes shone with intelligence, sincerity, and discrimination. This statesman has matched wits and emerged the victor in 1,000 legal, social, and political battles. No other leader in the world has attained the secure niche in the hearts of his people that Gandhi occupies. His famous title Mahatma, Great Soul. For them alone Gandhi confines his attire to the widely cartooned loincloth, symbol of his oneness with the downtrodden masses who can afford no more. The ashram residents are wholly at your disposal, please call on them for any service. With characteristic courtesy, the Mahatma handed me this hastily written note as Mr. Desai led our party from the writing room toward the guest house. Our guide led us through orchards and flowering fields to a tile-roofed building with latticed windows. A front yard well, 25 feet across, was used, Mr. Desai said, for watering stock. Nearby stood a revolving cement wheel for threshing rice. Each of our small bedrooms proved to contain only the irreducible minimum A-bed, handmade of rope. The whitewashed kitchen boasted a faucet in one corner and a fire pit for cooking in another. Simple Arcadian sounds reached our ears, the cries of crows and sparrows, the lowing of cattle, and the rap of chisels being used to chip stones. Observing Mr. Wright's travel diary, Mr. Desai opened a page and wrote on it a list of Satyagrahi vows taken by all the Mahatma's strict followers. Satyagrahis, non-violence, truth, non-stealing, celibacy, non-possession, body labor, control of the palate, fearlessness, equal respect for all religions, Swadeshi, use of home manufactures, freedom from untouchability. These 11 should be observed as vows in a spirit of humility. Gandhi himself signed this page on the following day, giving the date also August 27, 1935. 2 hours after our arrival my companions and I were summoned to lunch. The Mahatma was already seated under the arcade of the ashram porch, across the courtyard from his study. About 25 barefooted Satyagrahis were squatting before brass cups and plates. A community chorus of prayer, then a meal served from large brass pots containing chapatis, whole wheat unleavened bread, sprinkled with ghee, talsari, boiled and diced vegetables, and a lemon jam. The Mahatma ate chapatis, boiled beet, some raw vegetables, and oranges. On the side of his plate was a large lump of very bitter neem leaves, a notable blood cleanser. With his spoon he separated a portion and placed it on my dish. I bolted it down with water, remembering childhood days when mother had forced me to swallow the disagreeable dose. Gandhi, however, bit by bit was eating the neem paste with as much relish as if it had been a delicious sweetmeat. In this trifling incident I noted the Mahatma's ability to detach his mind from the senses at will. I recalled the famous appendectomy performed on him some years ago. Refusing anesthetics, the saint had chatted cheerfully with his disciples throughout the operation, his infectious smile revealing his unawareness of pain. The afternoon brought an opportunity for a chat with Gandhi's noted disciple, daughter of an English admiral, Miss Madeline Slade, now called Myra Bai. Her strong, calm face lit with enthusiasm as she told me, in flawless Hindi, of her daily activities. Rural reconstruction work is rewarding. A group of us go every morning at 5 o'clock to serve the nearby villagers and teach them simple hygiene. We make it a point to clean their latrines and their mud-thatched huts. The villagers are illiterate, they cannot be educated except by example. She laughed gaily.